You're listening to Civic Media. You can tune into any of our live shows on any radio station across the state with the Civic Media app. Find us in your phone's app store and listen anytime, anywhere.
You're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow on WAUK. My name is Greg Bach. I'm back. Happy Wednesday. And here's what's going on in southeastern Wisconsin this morning. It's been a little while since we heard from our friend Earl Ingram and his brand new show, What's Going On, where he has long-form conversations with some of the biggest leaders in Milwaukee and the Milwaukee area. And recently, he sat down with Robert Miranda from Campaign for Lead-Free Water. And if you know Earl, before he gets into a discussion about what that organization does for Milwaukee, he wants the listeners to know about Robert's story first.
I'm a child who got a chance to grow up in a time in our country where there were a lot of major changes going on. You know, as a child, I would look on the black and white television and all those Curtis Mathis TVs and watch all the social movements for change. You know, the push to desegregate the South, the attacks that were being levied against people of color who for years had to live under a system of separation. You know, I mean, I could recall times in Texas and other areas where my family would pull up and we'd have to go behind a restaurant to use the bathroom and see signs, you know, that say people of color here. You know, I mean, those things stick to you. Those things, you remember that. You know, you walk into a place and, you know, you see your mother be completely discriminated against. And as a child, you look at how they treat her and how they, I had a strong father, you know, and my father didn't put up with that. You know, and one of the things that really stuck with me was back in like 1971, we went to Cicero, Illinois, and we went into a restaurant, and my dad and my mom and I, we were waiting for, you know, the waitress to come over, but she wouldn't, you know. And my mom kept telling my dad, let's just go. And, you know, at the time, I was about 9 years old,
right.
You know, and I'm thinking to myself, well, what's going on? Why do we have to go? My dad's like, we can go nowhere. They're going to serve me. And my mother would say, no, let's just go. Don't start nothing. He said, no. You know, my dad had broken English. You
right.
Know? So you could just imagine, man, we not going no place. We gonna stay here. He and she gonna come and serve me. My dollar is green, just like everybody else's dollar is green. You know, that's the way he's, you know,
right.
My dad didn't play. And, you know, finally, you know, it was about 15 minutes sitting there. And my mother just basically convinced my dad and said, let's just get up and go.
So this is 1971. And
yeah.
Not in Alabama or Arkansas.
No, Cicero, Illinois. Yeah. I remember that very clearly. Very clearly. I remember it very clearly because when my dad got up and we started getting ready to leave, some white guy said, it's about time the air cleared in this area. And my dad turned around and slap the dog out of him.
You know,
and that sticks to your mind.
you know, Robert, your parents migrated here from Puerto Rico.
Correct.
And so immigrants.
Right.
And
he was good friends with Roberto Clemente.
Oh, man. The great Pittsburgh pirate.
Yeah. And he told me a story about Roberto Clemente in Pittsburgh when Roberto first got to Pittsburgh.
Community activist.
Yeah. And he actually, in Pittsburgh, Roberto was denied being able to buy furniture for his family when he first moved into Pittsburgh because of his skin color. And, you know, but those things stuck with me as a young man, and as I grew and understood how the power of bigotry works, how the power of racism and white supremacy works, and saw how it impacted lives of people of color in this country, it gave me that sense of, you know, that need to fight for justice. And over time, I have grown from being a person who's focused on fighting for the rights of people of color to the rights of fighting for humanity's rights.
But you're a Marine. You're a guy who spent 8 years. When you went to fight, when you joined the military, were you fighting for democracy? When you knew what was going on in this country?
Yeah, in 1982, I was deployed to Lebanon. I got a chance to see.
No, but why'd you join the military, man, after you saw what was going on?
After seeing everything that is going on, you still hold to that dream, you know? There is,
of what the nation could be?
Yes, yes, you know, because you saw the changes, too. Remember, at that time, you were able to see the Voting Rights Act
right.
being signed. You were able to see the changes that were going on. And so when seeing that, plus having a very good education, which I really credit my dad and my mom for giving me,
right.
they made sure that I was given an education that would give me the kind of abilities mentally to understand things. You believe in the fact that a country like the United States can change, can move on. And that ingrained in me even more when I joined the Marines and was deployed overseas.
Tune in tomorrow because I'll be playing another selection from Earl Ingram's interview with Robert Miranda of the Campaign for Lead-Free Water. And if you want to listen to the entire thing, go to civicmedia.us/shows. Look for What's Going On, and you can find the episode right there. It's called Talking with Robert Miranda. You can download it and listen to it anytime, anywhere on your device. Once again, that's civicmedia.us/shows. You're listening to WAUK's local report on Mornings with Pat Kreitloaf. To stay up to date with everything going on in southeastern Wisconsin, go to WAUKradio.com and sign up for our newsletter. For WAUK and Civic Media, my name is Greg Bach. I'll talk to you in 20 minutes. It's 6:59.
You're listening to Civic Media. Stay up to date on the latest news and information for your local community and Wisconsin by signing up for our free email newsletter. Visit civicmedia.us/email to get started.
You're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitloaf on WAUK. My name is Greg Bach. I'm back, and here's what's going on in southeastern Wisconsin this morning. Last month, southeastern Wisconsin was hit with historic and unprecedented flooding the likes we haven't seen in many, many years, leaving people with damaged homes and property. The cleanup is still ongoing, and FEMA is still doing their assessment on all the areas that were affected. But because next time is a when, not an if, it's important to have a plan in place. That's why Don Rosen spoke with the Racine County Office of Emergency Management about what you can do to stay safe and stay prepared.
It is time to get you prepared for any disaster that comes your way, except like maybe a phone bill in the mail that you didn't pay. Anything other than that, we're set for. And my guests are Lorenzo Santos. He's the director of the Racine County Office of Emergency Management, and Liz Adams, who is the deputy emergency management coordinator. This is part of our Racine County Traffic Safety Commission monthly get-together, Racine County Office of Emergency Management. Now, you can check this on the website. I figured out how to do it. It's Racine County/safety. Go down to the last one. That's the one we're talking about today. Racine County/safety. And you should be able to follow along with us today. Let's start off with the director, Lorenzo. Okay, so what kind of disasters are we looking at?
In Racine, you know, one of the biggest disasters that we're always looking for, since we're close to a body of water, close to the Root River, is flooding. We want to make sure that we're always prepared for that. And of course, as we come up on, you know, the fall and winter, we want to make sure that we are prepared for winter storms. Wisconsin is no stranger to winter weather, and that's something that we always want to make sure that we're preparing for here.
What can happen in winter I mean, I know tornadoes, hurricanes.
Sure.
I know earthquakes, all those kind of things. Tsunamis, that we don't have tsunamis here. But, you know, I've seen devastation from tsunamis. So what in winter? What can be the problem?
Yeah, winter can wreak all sorts of havoc. I mean, really, one of the biggest things that you see is obviously traffic flow changes when it becomes winter. You get a lot of snow. That morning commute or even afternoon commute will get a lot tougher to handle. It can have a huge effect on electricity. You know, a lot of times when we have a blizzard or a winter storm, all of a sudden the power goes out. So that's going to affect a lot of people's day, whether it's home or work. So those are, you know, just two general ways that that a heavy winter storm is going to affect your everyday life. We want to make sure that we're getting out is information to the public. We want to make sure that we're telling folks what the weather's going to look like. So we work very closely with NWS Milwaukee. We are always forecasting, you know, previewing what's going to happen and trying to get that information out and working with first responders, because they're going to be the folks that are out there making sure that everyone is safe. When people are calling in to dispatch, it's our first response teams that are going to go out making sure that they're helping everyone. We are those that the team in the background that is helping out our first responders, making sure that they have the information that they need and the resources to respond effectively.
Let me talk to Liz for a second here. It says make a plan.
Mm-hmm.
How do you make a plan for, well, tornadoes in our case, or even a snowstorm? Or we mentioned earlier that on, I was talking to you off the air, I thought it was in Kenosha. No, it had to be in Racine. A farmer's big tank of noxious chemicals spilled and it was in the air and there were homes nearby. How do you make a plan for something like that?
Yeah. So it's, basically, it's impossible to plan for everything. So what we try to do is develop principles and concepts that will be applicable no matter what the emergency. We call this all hazards planning. And you at home, you can also do something similar to this. You don't have to try to think about every possible emergency. I'm sure most people are not going to be planning for a hazmat release from a farm next door. But if you kind of know where the like evacuation route would be in your house, or if you know where like the rally point is in your yard for your family to meet up at, that can all be really helpful no matter what the emergency is.
How do you plan for a tornado? No, we don't get a lot of them in Racine. I have seen one before. When I took the doors off Menards on Highway 11 and also the roof off Case on Highway 11, how do you prepare for a tornado? Because, I mean, it'll rip your house right up the foundations if it hits you directly.
Yeah, tornadoes are definitely one of those hard ones because they can come out of nowhere. They happen very quickly, and a lot of times you get very little warning ahead of times. If you have a basement, if you have kids, letting them know, okay, if you hear the tornado sirens, go to the basement. If you don't have a basement, identifying a good place in your house to shelter from the tornado. If you're outside, generally knowing where to go if you hear the sirens or if you get the alert that there's a tornado warning imminent.
And you can't depend on cell phones, because if there's a storm, who knows if cell phone coverage will go out. And nobody's got landlines anymore, so yeah. You're dependent on cell phones. We're lucky because we're in good shape now. There are cities that are wiped off the map, and they say, well, our sirens weren't working. We were going to get new ones. It's too late now.
Sure.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So we're very lucky. So who's in charge of the sirens? Who tests them, blasts those out?
Well, often it comes down to individual municipalities. What I will say is, you know, we get a lot of calls. People ask, hey, you know, we could not hear the siren. A lot of times you're not going to hear it if you're inside. Maybe sometimes, depending on if you have music up loud, you're not going to hear it. So one of the things that I would say is one of the best things that you have in your toolbox to have that preparedness and have that situational awareness of storms is get yourself a NOAA radio, weather radio. Those are very important. They're very loud. If there are any kind of storms, any kind of alerts that come through, you're absolutely going to hear it. And it's going to be one of the best things that you can have available to make sure that you get that information in a timely manner.
Huge thanks to Lorenzo Santos and Liz Adams from the Racine County Office of Emergency Management for joining Don to talk about what you can do to stay more prepared in emergency situations. If you want to listen to that entire interview, go to civicmedia.us/shows. Look for the Don Rosen Show and find the episode entitled Getting Serious About Emergency Preparedness. You can download it directly to your device and listen to it anytime, anywhere. Again, that's civicmedia.us/shows. You're listening to WAUK's local report on Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. For WAUK and Civic Media, my name is Greg Bach. I'll talk to you in 20 minutes. It's 7:29. You're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow on WAUK. My name is Greg Bach, and I'm back, and here's what's going on in southeastern Wisconsin this morning. If you've been tuning in to Matinair on Air, you know that we've been talking a lot about the closure of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And today, we hear a conversation between myself, Greg Bach, and Brian Wadsworth, who's the Chief Operating Officer of Native Public Media. And instead of me getting into a long-winded intro, let's just go right to Brian talking about what Native Public Media is and what they do for the community.
Public Media, we are a Native-led nonprofit that works exclusively with tribally licensed radio and television stations throughout the country. We have a network of about 58 tribally licensed radio stations, as well as 3 tribally licensed radio or television stations throughout the country. And so the work that we do at Native Public Media, we work with our stations to work with them on their various compliance with the heavy regulations that they have being in broadcasting. So we work with them on their regulations. We also have, we offer training for our stations. We have an emergency management planning training as to get our stations prepared to stay on the air in the event of an emergency, as well as underwriting, how to generate funds from underwriting for our radio stations, and then our station support program, which was funded by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. We worked hand in hand with the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, as well as with the 36 tribally licensed radio stations that received the community service grant. So we have the unique opportunity to be able to work with them one-on-one, provide technical assistance with the I worked on the financial compliance aspect of their CSG grant, and then my counterpart, Kyler at City, our programs coordinator, worked with them on the non-financial compliance. So we got to help them out with, we tracked all of their financial data, all of their financial information, as well as our non-financial information. And probably the best part was being able to get out there and go out there and visit the stations, visit them on their homelands, and get to meet and get to know the station personnel. And they really do, they really are our family. So we were in a unique situation to be able to go out there and work with them, talk with our stations, see what's going on, and being able to serve as a liaison between the tribal stations as well as the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, and be able to, like I said, work hand in hand with them, and you know, really being able to be that liaison. So if there are issues going on with the station, we're able to actively communicate that with to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, whether that's personnel changes or if the station's struggling to, if they're having issues with our auditors or anything, any issues the stations were having, we were able to communicate that to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting and really help them understand some of the struggles that are going on within Indian Country. For example, one of our Alaska stations, their internet was cut off, and their nearest place they could get internet was about 6 hours away. And so, you know, we had to find some workaround since everything is online these days, and they didn't have access to reliable internet. So we had to find workarounds and, you know, hard mailing letters using snail mail or even utilizing faxes to get information from the station to the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
That is an amazing rundown of what you do. And I'm glad you made it that detailed, because you mentioned several times in there the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. And because of the big bill for billionaires, it has been zeroed out, which means at the end of this month, most of the jobs are going to be vacated and it's going to be closed permanently at the beginning of next year. We're losing the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, everyone. You've said this many times on the show. We spoke to Robert Pilot, who's the host of Native Radio, about this, but I wanted to talk to you because you are a part of a group that deals with a lot of stations. What does that closure mean for those stations, and what does it mean for Native Public Media?
Well, for our stations, if they were to go dark, I mean, those stations serve as a lifeline for our tribal communities. It's not just about broadcasting music, but they also offer programming in their indigenous languages. So for a lot of our tribes, that's how, you know, our youth, that's how they're able to learn their language. It's about being able to share information within their community, keeping their community updated on not only what's going on, you know, nationally, but also what's going on locally with their tribal governments and with their tribal councils and different events going on within the community, but also being able to share any sort of emergency information that happens within those communities, whether it's, you know, fire or flooding or tornadoes or active shooters. There's so many different, they are the lifelines for these communities, especially a lot of our tribes. They're located in rural areas. And some of the stations that we go visit, you know, we fly into a major airport and we're having to drive 2 to 3 hours to get to the station. So a lot of these stations are located in remote rural areas. And in some areas, they don't have access to broadband internet. I mean, my tribe, the Pyramid Lake Paiute tribe here in Northern Nevada, we just got hooked up with broadband internet. So we've had to, you know, utilize our cell phones as hotspots, which isn't the most reliable with cell phone service being out here in rural Nevada. So, you know, these remote tribes, they rely, and radio is the most is reliable, because, you know, if you have a signal, if you have your vehicle, or if you have a portable radio, you're able to get that information. So in a lot of the training we do with our stations, we train them on how to be prepared to stay on the air. So they're able to, you know, make sure this emergency information is being able to be disseminated to their communities. So, you know, when internet goes out, the power goes out, you know, our radio stations, they're able to stay on the air and they're able to keep their communities informed, and, you know, which is a lifeline for these communities.
I really encourage you to go to civicmedia.us/shows, look up Matt and Aaron Air, and find the episode entitled It's Always Been About Staying Resilient. You're going to listen to a great conversation with Brian Wordsworth from Native Public Media. And his insight shows that the closure of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting will have wide array effects on all sorts of stations when it comes to public broadcasting. You're listening to WAUK's local report on Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. To take your favorite WAUK shows with you on the go, download the free Civic Media app in the Apple or Google Play Store. For WAUK and Civic Media, my name is Greg Bach. I'll talk to you in 20 minutes. It's 7:59.
You're listening to Civic Media. Find the latest news, information, and archives of all your favorite shows on the Civic Media website, civicmedia.us.
You're listening to Mornings with Pat Kreitlow on WAUK. My name is Greg Bach. I'm back, and here's what's going on in southeastern Wisconsin this morning. Today, I'm very excited to introduce you to a friend of mine. His name is Charlie Nash, and he's the president and board chair of the Cream City Foundation in Milwaukee. And he joins me today to talk about their scholarship program, the people who applied, and what they do to invest in the community. But first, Charlie, please tell me a little history about the Cream City Foundation.
Yeah, great. Thanks for having me on, Greg. I really appreciate this. So Cream City Foundation is the second oldest LGBTQ-focused foundation in the country, which is, I think, something that's really interesting when you look at the history of Wisconsin and Milwaukee, that we have that kind of caliber of support for the community as part of our history. Me personally, I have been involved with the Cream City Foundation since 2021, in which I joined the board, and I have been the president and board chair of the foundation since 2023. So it's been my pleasure to kind of continue to take that history and that legacy of Cream City Foundation, whose mission is to fund LGBTQ plus equity in Southeast Wisconsin, and help continue to evolve that vision and evolve that mission as we take on some of the newer, in fact, I think sometimes more insidious attacks that we've seen on the community over the past few years.
And you've made the announcement that you are making scholarships available, and I wanted you to talk about that. We saw the press release, but tell me what you do with the scholarships and how they are going to impact those who receive them.
When we think about scholarships, there's many aspects to our programming that we have. Scholarships is something that we started doing more in force around 2015. And it's been a really successful program because we feel like it has a unique impact upon our community in a few different ways. The first is the concept of capacity building. So when we think about how do we truly enable equity for LGBTQ plus people, it is for all LGBTQ plus people. And I think we need to recognize that educational outcomes, the burden of debt and financial burden that people come out with from education can vary quite a bit. With underrepresented groups, people of color, transgender individuals that are often maybe facing many issues. And in a particular community, many people are working through high school and college in less stable home environments. And so that financial support for truly people to build the capacity, build the skills, so not only can they be successful in their lives economically, but also have the capacity to give back. That is something that we really believe, and it's important for us as a foundation to pay forward. So this year, we were excited to announce, actually for the third year in a row, we've had a record high funding for our scholarship program. And so we funded 20 scholarships for a total of $50,000, so $2,500 to 20 incredible students in our area. And you know, our hope is that those students will continue to stay in our area, continue to invest and see that investment made in them, and invest that time and energy back in their community in their lifetimes, whether regardless of what field they choose.
I think that's a great way of putting it. You are investing in these individuals so they can give something back. That is the important thing, especially about keeping people in Milwaukee and southeastern Wisconsin. It's about growing the community, the entire community, and through these scholarships, I can see as that is a great way to invest in our younger folks. With 20 scholarships, it must be a wide swath of individuals in the community. Can you tell me more about the folks who applied and those who got it?
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. You think with 20 scholarships, we actually have every year about 80 or 90 individuals that apply. So it's a very difficult set of decisions to even whittle it down to 20 and the $50,000 that we do have to invest. So the need is great. And many times the things that are making the decisions are individuals that we see a distinct need for the scholarships, individuals that have as well a demonstrated ability and capacity and desire to give back, as what I mentioned before. That certainly is something that we want to help encourage with our scholarship awardees. And in fact, we have our business quality luncheon coming up, which is our really premier event every single year in which we celebrate business equity, equity of LGBTQ plus people in the business world. And it's also our opportunity to honor our scholarship recipients. And so it's an incredible opportunity to sort of see the various experiences, have them join that kind of forum and really see, okay, here's an organization that is striving to give back. Here's how they can get involved and engage moving forward. So really exciting wide range of people that we see and want to continue to encourage participating in giving back to their community moving forward in all stripes, whether it's in the medical field, in things like history and art, or in many cases, things that may be seen as more, you know, trade related and very specific to their jobs and skills that they want to build as individuals.
This is great. I love hearing about these types of programs and giving back to the community. Charlie, if people want to know more about the scholarships going forward and just the Cream City Foundation, where do they want to go?
Right. Well, you can find us on Facebook, Instagram, Cream City Foundation. Otherwise, our website is creamcityfdn.org. And that's where you can find information about all of our programs, events, or even kind of when the next cycle of scholarships will come up.
Charlie Nash is the president and board chair of the Cream City Foundation. I really appreciate you coming onto the show today and talking about this wonderful program. And I look forward to talking to you very, very soon, my friend.
My pleasure, Greg. Thank you.
Thank you so much to Charlie Nash for being here to talk about the Cream City Foundation, and he will be back very soon to talk about another program that's coming out. So you want to stay tuned right here on WAUK and Civic Media. Again, if you want to find out more, go to creamcityfdn.org. And remember, you can always subscribe to our shows here at Civic Media as podcasts. Go to your podcast distribution center of choice, look for your favorite shows, and then when you subscribe, they're delivered to you every single time a new episode is available. Don't go anywhere, because after Mornings with Pat Kreitlow is Matinair on Air with me, Greg Box, sitting in for Jane Matinair. And today our guest is Andrew Watkins. She's a New York Times bestselling author, and Rick Reed, who is an economics professor from Fox Valley Technical College. Stay tuned. You're listening to WAUK's local report on Mornings with Pat Kreitlow. For WAUK and Civic Media, my name is Greg Bach. Have a wonderful Wednesday. I'll talk to you tomorrow. It's 8:29.
The national news cycle never stops, but it can be hard to find news about your local community. Civic Media is dedicated to providing quality local and state news coverage across Wisconsin. With the Civic Media app, you can get notifications about local stories that matter to you and your community. Find the free Civic Media app in your phone's app store and choose notifications from the menu to tell us what kind of news you want to hear about.